Chapter 2. Defender of Trinity. So far as anyone can tell, no congressman prior to Charlie Wilson had ever moved unsolicited to increase a CIA budget. From the beginning of the Cold War, Congress had granted that exclusive right to the president. But as dramatic as the doubling might sound, it had no visible impact on the war. It wasn't reported or debated, and it never even registered on the KGB's radar screen in Russia. At best, all it did was provide the Mujahideen with a few thousand more Enfield rifles and perhaps some machine guns so that they could go out and die for their faith in greater numbers. Wilson's intervention had not cost the congressman much more than a telephone call to a key staffer and a few additional minutes when the subcommittee met to appropriate the nation's secret intelligence budget. The truth is, it was an impulsive action, a personal gesture to bolster a painfully inadequate U.S. program. Wilson so easily crossed the line into this covert arena that no one stopped to question his right to be there or worry about the precedent he might be setting. It would be another 2 years before he would return to put this precedent to the test. But this is where, quite impulsively, he first demonstrated that there could be another power center in the American government, one that could act in a way that was totally unpredictable to drive a U.S. covert policy. For a moment, a very different Charlie Wilson had surfaced, a master politician able to find tools that could be used in ways that others would not have considered. But it had all taken place behind closed doors, and just for a fleeting moment. Before anyone could notice, the congressman had resumed the inexplicable role he had chosen for himself as a hopelessly irresponsible public servant. The truth is, there were always two Charlie Wilsons at work in Washington. But he was moving heaven and earth in those days to allow only one image to surface, and to promote that image so loudly that no one would go looking for the other. To begin with, he staffed his office almost exclusively with tall, startlingly beautiful women. They were famous on the Hill, known to all as Charlie's Angels. And to his colleagues' amazement, whenever questioned about this practice, Wilson invariably responded with one of his favorite lines, "You can teach them how to type, but you can't teach them to grow tits." That was the way he tended to present himself in public, which was tame compared to the way he decorated his condo. It was almost a caricature of what Hugh Hefner might have designed as the ultimate bachelor's lair. Manly hedonism was the theme, down to the last detail. Mirrored walls, an emperor's size bed outfitted with plush down pillows and a royal blue comforter, an entertainment center featuring a giant television and stereo, and a gleaming tanning bed to maintain his year-round tan. Finally, the congressman's most distinctive innovation, the jacuzzi, not hidden away in the bathroom, but so deliberately situated in the center of the bedroom that it forced the unsuspecting eye to draw all the worst possible conclusions about the man who slept in this room. Particularly when visitors came close and discovered silver handcuffs dangling elegantly from a hook within easy reach of the tub. The sight of these instruments of hedonism invariably left his colleagues and distinguished guests speechless. It would be an exaggeration to suggest that this was all a false front. Charlie Wilson, after all, is a bona fide hedonist. But he is also guilty of concealing his other identity. It's only when he's alone and everyone else is sleeping that the other Charlie Wilson surfaces. It's a nightly affair. Usually, at about 3 or 4 a.m., he finds himself awake and turns to his library with its thick volumes of military history. He's not like other insomniacs, who simply try to get back to sleep. He reads like a scholar steeped in his field, but also like a man in search of something personal, poring through accounts of the struggles of the world and the men who counted, Roosevelt, Kennedy, and all the great generals. But invariably, it is to the biographies and speeches and histories of Winston Churchill that Wilson always returns on these night journeys, to read again and again about the man who was cast into the political wilderness, written off as an alcoholic alarmist, and then, when all was lost, rose to the occasion to save his country and his civilization from the darkness of Hitler. It's no wonder that Charlie Wilson never shared his sense of personal destiny. It wouldn't have made much sense in his year of the hot tub had he even whispered of his inner conviction that he and Winston Churchill might have something, anything, in common. Nor did he explain why the painting over his bed, his one steady nightly companion, was like a talisman to him. The painting, a lone pilot in the cockpit of a Spitfire patrolling the night skies of London, had hung over his boyhood bed in tiny Trinity, Texas, at a time when the Nazis were sweeping across Europe. Night after night, on the second floor of the white frame house, in the corner room that Charlie shared with his Uncle Jack, the boy would sit staring out the window, ever vigilant, searching the sky for signs of Japanese bombers and fighter planes, whose characteristics were burned upon the memory of this 7-year-old defender of Trinity. "They aren't coming, Charlie," his kindly uncle would assure him. "But if they do, you'll be the first to see them." There was nothing distant or unfamiliar about World War II for the citizens of this timber town along the railroad tracks in deep East Texas. Every night, not just Charlie and his family, but everyone in Trinity gathered around their radios to find out how the war was going, knowing that everything rested on the outcome. When the Japanese struck at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, Charlie Wilson, age 8, sat in the living room of the white frame house across from the Methodist Church and listened to Franklin Roosevelt describe the Day of Infamy. The young boy with the huge imagination had already become obsessed with the war and with the magical voices coming out of the RCA radio. Roosevelt with his fireside chats, Murrow from London under the Blitz, and particularly Winston Churchill. It was a voice from far away, heard on a radio in a tiny town in the back of beyond. But those ringing, defiant words of Churchill, mocking Hitler and infusing a nation with the will to fight on no matter what the cost, never to be conquered, would leave Wilson forever struck by the power of one man's spirit to change history. Young Charlie began reading everything he could find about war, saving his money to send away for a giant American flag from Sears Roebuck, which he draped from the front of the house each morning. He bought a Canadian Mounties uniform and insisted on wearing it every day. He tried to stage mock battles with his friends, but no one would play the role of the Nazis or the Japs. All of Trinity was transformed by the war. Everyone gathered scrap metal for the cause, even the aluminum foil that wrapped chewing gum. Charlie's mother prepared bandages, and he and his friends helped assemble medical kits, putting their names and addresses inside. It was a great event when a soldier wrote back to thank them and report that he had used their kit after being wounded. Every soldier from Trinity had his picture in the window of the local drugstore. There were 80 or 90 of them, and whenever one would return, wounded or discharged, Charlie would sit at his feet at the soda fountain and listen to his stories. Often, he even saw the true face of the enemy close up. The War Department maintained a huge prisoner of war camp just 7 miles from Trinity at a railroad depot called Riverside. Trains would unload German prisoners, who would then march 3 miles to the POW camp. As Wilson remembers, "It was a great treat in 1943 when the town doctor drove me to Riverside to watch the men of the Africa Corps being unloaded. These were Rommel's troops. Those sons of bitches were goose-stepping off the train with great pride and arrogance in the very uniforms in which they were captured." The sight of goose-stepping Nazis burned deeply in the boy's consciousness. He had now seen the enemy. There they were, Hitler's men, just 10 miles from Trinity. The young Wilson began going to the library each day to read up on weapons systems. He felt particularly menaced by the Messerschmitts, the German fighter bombers that had savaged London, and he truly believed that Trinity might be next. In the post office they had posters of all the Japanese and German airplanes so we could spot 'em if they ever came over. Well, we had a little sawmill in Trinity, and all of us figured out it was probably a major target of the Japanese. Night after night, little Charlie Wilson would go to the window and scan the skies, Trinity's first line of defense, ready to spring at a moment's notice to alert the sheriff to a surprise attack. The Japanese finally surrendered. While his mother played the piano at a service of thanksgiving at the Methodist Church on VJ Day, the 11-year-old boy was permitted to climb into the steeple to ring the bells in triumph. Most boys his age did not follow the menacing transformation of America's World War II ally, the Soviets. Wilson had been thrilled when Stalin's forces had turned back the Nazis at Stalingrad in late 1942. But with increasing alarm, he read and listened to the accounts of Stalin gobbling up Eastern Europe. When Churchill came to America in 1947 and warned of an Iron Curtain falling over Europe, Charlie took his words to heart, and when the communists tested the bomb, Wilson was depressed for days, convinced that America had a new enemy every bit as dangerous as Hitler.